From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump returns from Singapore today after his historic meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un and the first photos ever of a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean dictator. It held a surprise. Trump said he would suspend what he called war games, the military exercises held by South Korea and the U.S. But as expected, the two leaders released a joint statement committing to work toward complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell today said he supports that goal.
If North Korea does not prove willing to follow through, we and our allies must be prepared to restore the policy of maximum pressure. Today, I congratulate the president on this major step and share his hope that it will begin a process that leads to an historic peace.
Well, we can't wait to hear what Jim Walsh thinks. He's Here and Now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. He's in the studio with us. Jim, you've been following this conflict for decades. You've been in North Korea, met with North Koreans around the world. Your thoughts?
Well, first last night, that was sort of a wow moment for me. When they shook hands and he's smiling and they put their arms around each other, I could not believe what I was watching on TV. Right. So that just as an individual. And then this morning, I guess I feel like that guy. There's this big dinner party being held by a friend down the street, and I show up for the big party. I'm really looking forward to it. I knock on the door. My friend comes out and says, you know, I've pushed it off till next week. And on the one hand, I'm happy that we're having the party, but I'm disappointed, and I'm hungry because...
Well, what would you want to hear?
I would have... In some ways, this is to be expected, right? There wasn't 3 years of preparation for this. They're trying to cobble it together at the last minute. And they weren't able to make progress. I would have liked to have seen some more specific announcements.
Well, for instance, there was no CVID, the acronym for the thing that the Trump
administration... Complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantle of
disarmament. That's suddenly gone, and that was a demand of the Trump administration.
It'll come back. Not all of those are achievable, especially the irreversible one, which is sort of a theme for today. So far, everyone's agreed to take some actions, but everyone can turn around and reverse those, right? So they can destroy this or a couple of those things, but they can rebuild them, and then we can halt our military exercises. But if things fall apart, we can reverse that too and start up again. So no real permanent commitments that are set in stone and unreversible so far.
What about this idea of denuclearizing the entire Korean Peninsula? That includes South Korea. And we know that the U.S. has nuclear weapons that are poised to protect South Korea. President Trump was asked about this morning on Good Morning America, and he said, oh, no, I don't mean that. How do we know that?
Well, we do have this. North Korea and South Korea did sign this in the 1990s, a denuclearization of the peninsula agreement. It's sort of fallen by the wayside. I personally don't have a problem with making the Korean Peninsula a nuclear-free zone. That if we have confidence that the North Koreans don't have nuclear weapons, then I don't see a reason why we would need to keep nuclear weapons in South Korea, particularly if our ally is not requesting them or insisting on it. So I think of that as a potential positive vision for the future. But obviously, there's a long way to go between where we are and where that is.
Well, and talk a little bit about that. There's a little bit of politics here. But you know, President Trump has slammed President Obama for the deal that he struck with Iran.
Yes.
But many have said, but that worked.
Yes.
So what does he have to do here? What has to happen here to even equal that?
Well, I think that there are just some physical facts here that are in play. There is no way you're going to get a deal that is a strong verification as the Iran deal. Just ain't going to happen.
Because there's so much more in
yes,
North
first
Korea.
Of all, Iran never produced nuclear weapons. Right. North Korea has. North Korea is a country, I've been there, of mountains. We have no baseline, right? Where the inspectors haven't been there in forever. At least during the Iran negotiations and all that squabbling, there were inspectors still inspecting those sites. We haven't had anyone in North Korea for ages. We don't know, you know, if they stuck a bunch of stuff in a mountain, we don't know. We're not going to be able to find it. So, and that's okay, right? People insist on 100% verification. There's never 100% verification. But the truth is, because North Korea is harder to verify, the Iran agreement will, without doubt, have stronger verification provisions than whatever agreement we get with North Korea. That's just the way it is, and you just have to live with it.
During his press conference after the summit, President Trump was asked what he'd do if Kim didn't follow through. He said, I just feel very strongly he will. My instincts, my ability, my talent, they want to make a deal, he said. But here's what he said when asked, what if they don't?
Honestly, I think he's going to do these things. I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey, I was wrong. I don't know that I'll ever admit that, but I'll find some kind of an excuse. Okay, one or two. One more. Come on.
But
Okay. the president.
Awesome.
But
awesome.
But is there maybe something to the fact that we have a former reality TV show president and a basketball player, Dennis Rodman, who was also there, who actually got very tearful on CNN saying, I told people, I'm the one who went to North Korea, I told people this might happen. Is it possible that these two unique individuals could be the ones to bring North Korea into the light?
It is possible. It's unlikely, but it is possible. And I think we should cling to that as a possibility. We should test that proposition until it falls apart. You know, North Korea has lots of reasons why, you know, there are lots of reasons to be skeptical here. But it's a one-person dictatorship. If the one person changes his mind, then everything changes. And so, yes, that's the beauty of going top down, starting at the top and then working down. But then there are risks, and we've sort of seen those risks in the last 24 hours, that if you don't have a lot of preparation, then you're not going to have a lot at the end of the meeting.
No. Jim Walsh here now, security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. We'll be talking to you again. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Thousands of Southern Baptists are gathering today in Dallas for their annual meeting, but Paige Patterson, once a giant of the church, announced he will not be delivering the event's keynote sermon. He's been in the midst of a scandal for weeks about statements he's made in the past about women. As KERA's Christopher Connolly reports, America's more than 46,000 Southern Baptist churches are now grappling with their own Me Too moment.
Patterson's troubles began in April when an old interview he gave was reposted on a Baptist blog. In it, he tells the story of a woman at his church who asked for help because her husband was abusing her.
I said, all right, what I want you to do is every evening I want you to get out by your bed just as he goes to sleep. Get down by the bed, and when you think he's just about asleep, you just pray and ask God to intervene.
Patterson says the next time he saw the woman, she had two black eyes.
And she said, I hope you're happy. And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. And I said, I'm sorry about that, but I'm very happy. And what she didn't know when we sat down in church that morning was that her husband had come in and was standing at the back, the first time he ever came.
Thousands of Southern Baptist women signed a letter calling for Patterson to resign as president of the Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth. Then allegations came out that Patterson told a woman who'd been raped not to go to the police. He was fired from the seminary on May 30th.
His fall from this high and mighty place in the last few weeks has been just a really stunning turn of events.
Karen C. researches American evangelicalism and gender at the University of Arizona. She says it's impossible to understate Patterson's power among Southern Baptists. A one-time president of the Southern Baptist Convention, he was a major architect of the denomination's rightward shift starting in the 70s.
Women's issues certainly were central to the conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Southern Baptists have adopted a view of gender relations called complementarianism, a counter, in many ways, to feminism. It says God created men and women differently, and therefore they have different roles and obligations in the church and in the family.
Its focus is on the importance of women's submission to men's leadership and spiritual headship in both the home and the church.
And that means women can't fill top leadership positions in Southern Baptist churches. But proponents of complementarianism say God didn't assign women inferior status. And Jim Richards from the Southern Baptists of Texas Convention says it's absolutely not meant to excuse or give license to abuse.
Obviously, God's word would tell us to protect the innocent and would call for that woman to be rescued from whatever situation that she would be in that would be dangerous physically, emotionally, or otherwise.
Richards has signed on to a resolution affirming the value of women and calling on church leaders to do better by them. It'll be voted on at the annual meeting this week.
It is a teaching moment, and I do believe that definitely Southern Baptist churches are going to be different because of what we are experiencing right now.
The convention's research arm has surveyed Protestant pastors about domestic violence. Scott McConnell from Lifeway Research says pastors across the board see their churches as safe havens for victims of domestic violence.
But when we ask that practical question of, do you have a plan in place if somebody says, I'm being abused, do you have a plan to actually help them? The answer is only half of churches have a plan in place.
McConnell's research also shows a lot of pastors don't often preach about these issues, and disapproval of divorce complicates the conversation. But he says things in the church have been changing, and there's more room now for those complicated conversations.
You know, those that are retirement age or close to it, they tend to see the church as a place where everything needs to be nice and neat. And I think the younger generations are very much wanting the church to address life in its messiness.
Now, in this Me Too moment, McConnell says many millennials expect churches to take on previously taboo issues like violence against women. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
Summer officially starts next week, which in most of the country means hotter weather. Record heat is expected across the U.S. from Utah to Minnesota, Florida to Texas. And a lot of people will be using their air conditioners. We're going to take a look now at that industry and some of the best ways to keep your home cool with Glenn Horahan and Todd Washam, who are with the Air Conditioning Contractors of America. They're with us now. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And let me start with a very basic question, but one that probably a lot of our listeners don't know. How does an air conditioner work?
Basically, what you're doing is you're moving the heat from the inside of the home to the outside of the home. And you're doing that by change of state of a fluid, the refrigerant. And so it changes from a gaseous to a liquid state. And when it does that, it removes a lot of BTUs of energy with it. And so taking the air that blows over the indoor coil, which then moves that coolness throughout the house.
And do you need a refrigerant for an air conditioner? Is there any air conditioner that doesn't have a refrigerant?
Yes, it's called the fan.
Doesn't work quite the same way.
That was a joke.
Well, and the technology, though, has changed significantly over the years. What's the difference between an air conditioner from 20 years ago and one from today?
Oh, quite a bit more electronics and circuit boards and controls and logic, all done to make the equipment operate more efficiently, provide better indoor air comfort. And some other changes are, 20 years ago, everybody had single-speed equipment. It was either on or was off. Today, there's variable-speed equipment and multiple-speed equipment, depending on how hot or cold it may be outside.
Are they using less energy now?
Yes. Today's equipment is dramatically more energy efficient than equipment from just even 7, 8, 10 years ago. And, you know, the minimum SEER, which is seasonal energy efficiency ratio, the minimum SEER available today that you, by law, you can buy is 13 in some places, but most of the country it's 14.
And what does 13 or 14 mean?
It's a ratio. It's sort of like your miles per gallon. So the higher the number, the more efficient the box is operating at under laboratory conditions. And so there's equipment out there that does double what the minimum is, but it become much more expensive as you move on. And Todd may want to speak about the other part of efficiency.
Yeah, so the equipment is a lot more efficient today, but still half of the systems in the U.S. are using more energy than what the label says on them.
Hmm.
The EPA estimates that half of all HVAC systems in the U.S. are not installed according to the manufacturer's recommended installation standards. So you have a 14 SEER unit, and half of those units are operating at an 8 to 10 SEER level.
Why is that?
Well, initially, they're not. A lot of contractors out there don't do what's called a load calculation to determine what size that you need to be installing either in a new home or retrofitting, replacing in an existing home because the system failed. Over the last 20 years, homeowners have done significant upgrades to their houses. They put in double pane windows. They put in more insulation. They have better doorways. They sealed the house. And so the size of the air conditioner that was put in 20 years ago is way, way, way oversized when you compare what they need today in that home to operate. And too many contractors will put like for like in and not realize that this oversized box satisfies the thermostat very, very quickly now and turns off so it doesn't remove the moisture. So there's one aspect that it's an oversized box pulling larger amps because it has a larger compressor and larger motors and larger fans. And then when you install new equipment in, say, an existing home, the condition of the ductwork in that home is very important. Currently, you lose about 10 to 40% of the airflow from the system through the ducts into the rooms. It's being lost in the attic or crawl spaces or interstitial wall cavities, but it's not getting where the people are so the people can be comfortable. So that's lost energy there.
Now, obviously, everybody is different in terms of what temperature that they want in the house, but what do you recommend for what you should set your AC at?
Right. So ACA recommends setting the thermostat at 75 degrees Fahrenheit for summer cooling and 68 degrees Fahrenheit for winter heating. Obviously, people are going to set it the temperatures they're most comfortable at. In my particular case, I am very happy at 78 degrees for summer cooling
Wow.
when the humidity is under 50%. So if you control humidity, you can set your thermostat up higher. Many people have gone into homes or in commercial buildings where it's cold and clammy. And what that means is this is an example of a system being oversized. The thermostat shuts off too quickly. The moisture, the humidity is not reduced. And as a result, people turn the thermostat down lower and lower in an effort to get comfortable. And they wind up being colder temperatures and clammy because there's still a lot of humidity. But if you control the moisture and get the moisture out, you can be very comfortable at higher temperature settings, which saves you money.
One thing that I have tried is turning the AC on just for like an hour before bed and then turning it off, and it ends up keeping the house cool enough at night.
That's because you don't have the sun beating down on
Right.
the home, so you really don't have a heat load. So that does work. If you have a properly sized system, what our directions are is that you'd set the thermostat and leave it there, and the system will come on as needed. If you get too far off a set point when it's time to come back to the thermostat setting, the motors all have to work harder than they should and takes longer to get to the comfortable set range, which is why people use programmable thermostats
mm-hmm.
because it allows the programmable thermostat to bring the unit on an hour beforehand. So instead of you waking up early and resetting the manual thermostat to be comfortable for the rest of the family, the thermostat does it for you. So when you wake up, it's comfortable for you.
What do you say to people who just decide that fans are good enough for them instead of ACs?
If it's good enough for them, great. And there's a lot of parts in the country, Pacific Northwest, that air conditioning is really not a necessity because they don't have that many days that gets very hot. The Northeast part of America, same thing. You know, they don't have a very long summer period as well. And so fans may work for them. Chicago, you would think Chicago would be, you know, it's cold in the wintertime, but they have very much the same type of weather as Florida does. And so many times you can have just a fan and most people are comfortable. But occasionally Chicago gets those heat
yeah.
waves. And about every few years we hear about people dying because they didn't have air conditioning because it is something you need to preserve your health and well-being.
Now, Texas's main power grid operator warned earlier this year that the state may experience blackouts this summer because of the heat and the power needed to run air conditioners. Do you think we're going to start to see that more often because of climate change, because of rising temperatures, that people are going to need to use their air conditioners much more and we're going to see the power grids have a problem?
Well, our message is that you can help address that issue by working with contractors and homeowners to ensure their HVAC systems are installed properly. If they're installed properly, you're going to have 30 to 40% less energy being used in those systems. So it may not help with the exact peak demand that utility operators are looking for, but it will help on the overall use of the grid.
I want to ask you one more thing. We've talked about the energy use of an air conditioner, but what about CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons? These are things that are not great for the environment and people have some concerns about.
Right. Well, the CFCs have been gone for a number of years now. They've been replaced by and large by what's called HCFCs, which are hydrochlorofluorocarbons. And because they still have a ozone depletion potential, those also basically are on the tailing end of being phased mm-hmm. out. And the replacements to those have been HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons, which have no ozone depletion potential. However, they have a global warming potential. So there's a lot of work being done with the US EPA, states, and otherwise who are looking at mandating that specific substances that have even more environmentally benign properties be used. So these shifts in changing technologies take anywhere from, you know, 5, 10, or 15 years. So it's a slow process where everybody has to watch and monitor and see how we move forward.
So there are still some ACs out there that are using CFCs?
There are probably some very old centrifugal chillers and large commercial buildings that are using CFCs. By and large, residential applications did not use very many CFCs at all. They did use hydrochlorofluorocarbon R22, so HCFC-22, which had a slight ozone depletion as well as a global warming potential.
And some of the new refrigerants coming online, they will be non-ozone depleting, low global warming potential, but they will also likely be flammable. Hmm. And this is an issue when we start talking about improperly installed HVAC systems.
So, Glenn, you say you keep your home at 78 in the summer. Todd, what about you?
I keep mine at 70.
It's pretty different.
I think my system is oversized. I've just moved into a new house, and it shuts off more often than I think it should.
Yeah. So my house, when I rebuilt my house, I put a lot of insulation. I used foam insulation in the walls. I encapsulated the attic, which means that there's foam on the roof deck. And the attic temperature is the same temperature within a degree or two as my conditioned space below. And so as a result, I'm able to be very comfortable in, you know, long pants and long sleeve shirts in my house at 78 degrees. But my RH is in the range of 40 to 45%.
Well, you got to go over to Todd's house and fix it.
Well, I'm one of the lucky ones who knows what to ask my contractor when I have him come over for my service agreement.
Right.
But a lot of homeowners don't know the right questions to ask.
That's Todd Washam and Glenn Horahan with the Air Conditioning Contractors of America. Learned a lot of new facts about air conditioners. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
The heat is on. Robin, where do you keep your thermostat?
You mean the air conditioner?
Yeah.
I hate air conditioners.
Yeah.
I hate them. I won't turn them on unless the cats are uncomfortable.
Let us know your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump spoke afterwards on ABC's Good Morning America.
We have the framework of getting ready to denuclearize North Korea.
Yeah, and the phrase in the document is complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Does that mean that the nuclear umbrella that we have over South Korea is on the table for negotiation?
No, that means that they're going to get rid of their nuclear weapons. We never even discussed the other.
The president also surprised everyone by saying he would suspend military exercises between South Korea and the U.S. The BBC's Robin Brandt is in Seoul. How are people there reacting to that?
Well, look, I think it's quite clear that the North Korean, or rather the South Korean leadership, didn't know this was coming on a political level and also on a military level. We've had a statement from U.S. Forces Korea. They said there was no guidance in terms of any change to the execution of any forthcoming exercises. So it looks like the military here, the U.S. military, didn't know. It looks like Moon Jae-in, this country's president, didn't know. We've heard from Moon Jae-in's spokeswoman saying that they need to try and analyze and understand the meaning and intent of the words coming from the president. But many people here will frankly find this unsettling. These exercises as far as the North is concerned, are incendiary. Kim Jong-un hates them because he sees them as a reminder of the invasion threat. But here in the South, it's a reminder of the resilience of the alliance between South Korea and the United States. And it's also a show of strength that many here think is absolutely crucial in terms of sending that message to the North.
The South did say more in their statement. They say, we believe we need to pursue various measures to efficiently move the dialogue forward during serious ongoing talks to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, to establish good relations between North Korea and the U.S., you know, holding out some hope that this could yet work. But it sounds like jitters there in South Korea. There is no definition yet of denuclearization. It just says work towards it. The U.S. also has nuclear weapons that are meant to protect South Korea. Is there concern that those might have to be withdrawn?
Well, look to the wording in the document that was agreed by both these men. It committed the North and the South to denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. That includes North, that includes South. And the key thing for Kim Jong-un has always been he is not going to sacrifice these weapons that have brought him this far. So we don't still understand what the definition of denuclearization is in terms of both these parties. What we do know, though, is that the United States has agreed to some security assurances described by Mike Pompeo the day before as being unique. And that, to me, seemed like it involved troop numbers. And we now know, as far as the president's concerned, that involves this symbolic ending of these joint military exercises. As I said, Kim Jong-un finds so threatening.
How were people in the South feeling about seeing the North Korean president standing in front of American flags, shaking the hand of an American president?
Look, there are some in this country who want peace at kind of any price. There are others who believe the image of President Trump alongside this despot, this authoritarian man who oversees this pariah state, as being reprehensible. But, you know, on the whole, the de-escalation of tension here, the lowering prospect of any kind of military confrontation certainly is, of course, broadly welcomed. And people think that the president should be praised for that.
The BBC's Robin Brand in Seoul, South Korea. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
The total number of movie theaters in the U.S. has been falling since 1995, and last year the number of tickets sold hit its lowest level since 1992, according to Box Office Mojo. But that hasn't stopped Moctezuma Esparza from opening five new theaters in California. His Maya Cinemas company aims to bring movie theaters to underserved communities with large Latino populations. Moctezuma Esparza joins us now from Pasadena for today's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's a pleasure to be here. I love listening to your show.
Well, thank you. And where did this idea come from?
Well, I had a career as a movie producer, a very successful and enriching and career that allowed me to focus on my own cultural heritage. I made movies like The Milagro Beanfield War, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, Selena. As part of that career, I got to travel the United States organizing the premieres for my movies. And so for Milagro Beanfield War, which Bob Redford directed, I went to 20 cities to arrange benefit premieres where we raised scholarship money. And I found that there were no first-run movie theaters in any Latino community in the United States. This is 1987.
Right.
10 years later, when I did the same for the movie Selena, I found that even the second-run movie theaters had closed in Latino communities. And so I thought about what I had experienced and said, this is a opportunity. It's a business opportunity, and it related back to my own childhood, where the most treasured moments that I have of memories with my dad was him taking me to the movies on his one day off on Monday, where I got to see Mexican movies where, of course, Mexicans were the good guys, the bad guys, the guy who took right. The girl who managed to achieve her dreams, all of that.
And you grew up, by the way, in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of L.A. You were able to walk to the movie theaters.
I grew up in Boyle Heights, yes, the original suburb of Los Angeles. And there were three movie theaters within walking distance. Today, you know, I live a few miles away from Boyle Heights, not far from where I grew up. And there are no movie theaters. And those movie theaters are now churches or flea markets, or they've been torn down. And all across the United States, the urban center core has pretty much been turned into an entertainment desert. And I view entertainment as part of the needs of being human, right? Just as much as food and shelter are a need, we need to be able to get out of our head. We need to be able to dream. We need to be able to see something else as a possibility for our lives than what we go through every day.
Why do you think, though, that those neighborhoods have become entertainment deserts?
Well, there's complicated reasons that have to do with the nature of the abandonment of the intercity altogether and the building of malls and of super shopping centers in the suburb and in affluent communities where large developers want national retailers who are credit tenants, which is where they get AMC, Regal, and Cinemark to be their tenants. And so there are no developers who are working in the inner cities, in Latino working class communities. So as a consequence, you don't have the national tenants and you don't have the big modern movie theaters, which is where the cinema industry migrated to.
So what's been the reaction to your theaters? Have you seen them fill up with people in Latino neighborhoods?
We have been resoundingly a success. And I knew it would be because Latinos are reported by the Motion Picture Association as the highest frequency moviegoers of any ethnic group in the United States. We love movies and we go as a group, we go as a family, and we go often. And so I knew that in these communities, actually movie going, even though we are the most frequent moviegoer, was depressed because people have to drive a long distance. And the further you are from a quality venue, the less often you go.
And what kind of films are you showing?
We show first-run Hollywood films, and we take one or two screens, and we specialty program them with art films, documentaries, Spanish-language films, American Latino films, which is a completely different thing, not Spanish-language films. This is a separate category, and they don't get supported, and the studios generally don't make those movies, and the independent filmmakers who manage to make one rarely get invited into the theatrical mainstream cinemas. So we're committed to all of that, and we are a first-run mainstream cinema.
You say Latinos love to go to the movies. I wonder, though, if you think that, like the general population, they're going to migrate to their TV screens and Netflix and all the new entertainment venues that we have.
Well, that's a wrong concept. It's completely doesn't speak to how humans behave, right? So movie theaters compete with what you do out of the home, not with what you do in the home, right? So I'll remind you, I don't know how old you are, but there was a moment where television came in and color TV was this amazing thing. And then there was pay TV, and then there was VHS, and then there was DVDs, and then there was HBO, and then Netflix through the mail, and then Netflix streaming, and then there was Hulu and Zulu and all the other forms of entertainment that are delivered in the home. None of them depressed movie going. In fact, there is hard studies that show that they promoted movie going. Throughout the last 70 years, the average attendance for the average American has been between 4 and 5.5 times do they go to the movies a year. So the whole notion that a big giant 75-inch television screen at home is going to convince people not to get out of their house and go see the new Star Wars movie in a theater where they can have a group experience is just wrongheaded. You've got a kitchen, but you go out to eat. Okay, you can have the best home entertainment session outfit at your home, and you still want to get out of your house. And for Latinos and working class communities in particular, the best value out of the home is a movie.
So what do you make, though, of headlines like one that I'm looking at right now? 2017 saw the lowest level of U.S. movie theater attendance since 1992.
Well, it was still huge, and it only went down 2%. So you can, you know, spin it any way you want. Our movie theaters are very successful. Our attendance is superior to the national attendance, and it's recession-proof. Throughout the entire Great Recession, movie attendance went up, box office revenues went up. What you do have is a correlation to the price of a ticket and attendance. There is a price sensitivity.
What are you charging at your theaters?
We generally charge a dollar less than the major circuits. Mm. And that makes a difference to a family of six.
We're talking here about movie theaters. What about the industry in general? Are you seeing more opportunities for Hispanic filmmakers and actors than there used to be?
Actually, there is less today, ironically. Hmm. You know, again, another misconception. If you go back 50, 60 years, you can think of Anthony Quinn, Ricardo Montalban, José Ferrer, Fernando Lamas, Gilbert Rowland, Dolores del Río, Katy Jurado, Rita Hayward. These are all movie stars who could greenlight a movie, who headlined movies. And I challenge you to give me one name of an American Latino, not a European, not a Latin American, an American Latino, like the names I just gave you, who can headline and greenlight a Hollywood mainstream movie.
So why do you think that is, that there aren't any American Latinos who have risen to the top in 2018?
Well, it's a complicated story, but certainly the political climate today is a reflection of the deep-seated historical enmity that exists in this country towards people of Mexican descent. There are 60 million, quote, Latinos in the United States. Two-thirds of them were born in the United States. That's 40 million. Mm-hmm. Those are inherently Native American Latinos, okay? And they're invisible. Everybody thinks of us like we're all immigrants, okay? My family came to the United States before the United States existed.
So are we going to start to see your theaters all over the country?
I sure hope so. That's my plan.
Where's the next opening?
We have a theater under construction in North Las Vegas, Nevada. We'll start construction of our seventh location in Dallas, Texas, and then we're moving to Phoenix and then to Indio, California. And we're looking at many other communities across the country.
That's Moctezuma Esparza, who is a filmmaker, entrepreneur, and activist. He runs Maya Cinemas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And we may have a decision today on AT&T's hope for merger with Time Warner. A federal judge is expected to issue his long-awaited opinion on the $85 billion deal later this afternoon. The Justice Department sued to block the merger, saying it would limit competition and raise costs. But today's opinion could also indicate the fate of other major deals, including Disney's offer to buy 21st Century Fox and T-Mobile's proposed merger with Sprint. Here to talk about that and more, our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is executive editor for Recode. Peter, do you have any indication which way this opinion's going to go?
The stock market and people who work at AT&T and Time Warner seem increasingly confident that the deal is going to allow AT&T to buy Time Warner. If you look at Time Warner's stock price, it's been ticking up sort of through the spring, through the trial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a single judge that's going to make a ruling sometime after 4 o'clock this afternoon. So without going in his head, we don't really know.
Well, we know a couple of things, and we're going to pick that up in a second, Judge Leon. But to back up, this would be a vertical integration. Two companies that aren't competitors, AT&T, a company best known as a cell phone provider, wants this deal with Time Warner, a big media company, because they want the content, right?
Yeah, I sort of remain a little bit confused about why they really want to do this deal. I interviewed the CEO of AT&T, Randall Stephenson, a couple of weeks ago and asked him about this repeatedly. His argument is essentially, we think we can improve the media business by sort of integrating it with the pipes that we own, both the phone connections we have. We also bought DirecTV, a big TV distributor. If we think we stack all that stuff together, we can make a better product.
Okay. Well, it's not, though. You stack it, so it's not a horizontal deal, which is
right.
When they're competitors, they do the same thing. And that's usually when the Justice Department gets involved, because if you've got two companies that do the same thing and they combine, then you have less competition. They don't usually get involved in vertical deals. So why did this Justice Department, why are they against this? Why do they think it'll raise costs?
That depends on who you ask. The Justice Department's argument in court is we think because video distribution and video content are so now dependent that locking the two of them up together can cause real problems for both consumers and competitors. By the way, we allowed Comcast to buy NBC Universal years ago. NBC and Universal – Comcast agreed to behave responsibly, and they haven't. And if you ask the antitrust regulator who's suing to stop this deal, he says, look, that's – what we don't want to do is have to go back in and sort of police this deal. We'd rather structure it in a way that either works or doesn't work and not have to do what we call a behavioral remedy. The more cynical slash skeptical view of this is – Donald Trump is upset with CNN. He's been campaigning against it for years, and that he has personal animus against CNN and, by extension, Time Warner, and wants to stop the deal for that reason.
Okay, and let's further explain. Time Warner owns CNN, HBO, and the Justice Department is saying that if AT&T acquires them, they might charge other carriers more to air those things, and they would have an unfair advantage, and that's where the raised costs would be.
Yeah, but, and that's where I get really confused, because AT&T says, no, we can't do that. The whole premise of owning of HBO is that it's widely distributed. It's available to people who have Comcast or Charter or AT&T, which is why I'm confused about what the benefit of actually owning it is.
Well, but Trump did say when he was campaigning, AT&T is buying Time Warner. This is at a campaign rally when the deal was announced. He said, it is a deal we will not approve in my administration. Now, you know, the government says, no, we didn't talk to him about it. But Trump did say that. And Judge Leon, back to the judge, he refused to allow any of AT&T's efforts to introduce that into the trial.
Like other things Donald Trump has said, this is one of the things that on the outside people have to figure out. Did he mean that? Did he mean it in the moment? Is this just something he said? We still really don't know. You can sort of see the AT&T people have been arguing this is a politically motivated case, but they can only go so far in that argument in court. And they've just sort of agreed to sort of bite their tongue. They want to get the deal through.
Okay. So we wait to see this afternoon. But we also wanted to ask you about yesterday when the Federal Communications Commission repealed net neutrality. It became official yesterday. This, of course, the requirement enacted under President Obama that service providers have to give equal access to all web content. They can't speed some up and slow others down. Can't give something an unfair advantage. This is a big win for the Trump administration.
It's a big win for the telecom companies who pushed it. Again, I'm not sure that the Trump administration really cared about it one way or the other. Again, this is not something Donald Trump campaigned on.
His FCC chair is Ajit Pai. And
it is a policy enacted by the Trump administration. So it's something he implicitly or explicitly wanted. Again, I don't think that he cares about it at all. And the real question is what's going to happen near term? There's going to be continued court fights about this. Folks who want to keep net neutrality are going to take this to court. You've got individual states sort of saying, well, we're going to enforce our own net neutrality agreements regardless of what the federal government says. And then long term, if this repeal sticks around for a while, the question is, how would a regular person or even a company notice that net neutrality, the absence of net neutrality is starting to affect them one way or another? And it might be a boiling frog situation where you don't notice anything in the near term, and over the long term, you go, wait a minute, what just happened over the last 5 years?
Right. Everything got slower or certain things got faster. But
right.
I just want to check because we didn't feel anything yesterday. No, like seismic thing. Okay.
This broadcast is still going through.
Peter Kafka, a perfect name for this. Executive editor of Recode, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.